Good afternoon, my name is Jim Scher, I represent the appellant, Pacific Avenue Enterprises and Mr. Bowles. This is an appeal from a order of dismissal issued by the district court pursuant to Rule 12b-5, dismissing our complaint intervention and also denying our request to amend the complaint intervention. The issue on appeal, I think, is whether the transaction which is described in our pleadings supports an inference of a fraudulent transfer under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act 38-8101 at SEC, and if so, whether the district court's prior findings and orders in the case contradict the allegations of the pleadings such as to entitle the court to disregard those allegations in our pleadings. The case was a receivership action that was originally filed by Community Bank of Colorado, who is not a party to this appeal, asserting default on approximately $7.2 million in secured debt. It was filed against two companies, Guarantee Enterprises in Oklahoma City and Omni Hospital Services in Grand Junction. Both were commercial laundry businesses. Both were owned by the same person, Mr. Roger King and his wife. A receiver was appointed at CBC's request in December of 2011. In June 2012, the bank filed a motion for approval of sale of the two companies. And under the terms of that, terms that were presented to the district court, Guarantee Enterprises was to be sold to an entity called Healthcare Laundry Services, and Omni Hospital Services was to be sold to an entity called Omni Linen Services for the collective price of $2 million. And the agreement further provided that the bank was going to accept the $2 million paid to the receiver in satisfaction of its secured debt against the two companies.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to interrupt you if I can, because I assure you we've all read the briefs and you don't need to spend your very valuable time telling us the facts. I'm going to jump right in. Let me tell you the issue that concerns me most about your argument is that your colleague across the aisle here says there's no transfer of assets here. These assets are all subject to lien. You, I think, tried to respond to that in your reply brief, and I'm being very candid, I didn't quite follow your argument. Why is there a transfer of assets here? Why do you have assets under CUFTA?
If you look at the way the actual transaction was structured as it's alleged in the pleadings, what happened here was that Kairos Capital, which owned both OLS and Healthcare Laundry Services, had a prearranged sale of the Guarantee Enterprises business to Ecotex, an outfit out of Washington State. What happened was Ecotex paid the $3.2 million for Guarantee Enterprises, i.e. Healthcare Laundry Services, and simultaneously the bank, upon receiver's receipt of the $2 million that Kairos gave to the receiver out of that $3.2 million, released its security agreement or security interest in the assets both of Guarantee Enterprises and Omni Hospital Services. So at the time the transfer actually occurred to Healthcare Laundry Services, that lien, that security interest, had been released by virtue of the payment of the $2 million.
So is your argument that this is essentially a series of two separate transactions?
It was all one transaction, I think, is the best way to look at it.
I agree with that, and I think that's what's causing me some concern. If it's all one transaction, doesn't the lien get released when the assets get transferred?
The lien got released when the money got paid. In other words, the payment upon receipt of $3.2 million by Kairos. Kairos took $2 million of that, gave it to the receiver. At that point, the security interest was released, and the assets of both Guarantee Enterprises and Omni Hospital Services were transferred to the other two entities, free and clear of that security interest.
Right, so for you to say that there's an asset here, you have to, I suppose, we're at an allegation stage, that the lien was released first, and then there was a transfer. That's basically your argument?
I think it's logical. I mean, if I'm a purchaser, I'm certainly want those security interests released and have those assets free and clear.
But isn't the reality that it's just like a real estate closing, that you've got property, you got debt, you got an encumbrance on the property, and you got a new buyer, and for the deal to work, everything has to happen at the same time. The debt gets paid, the encumbrance is released, clear title goes to the buyer, and the buyer goes away happy. That's all that happened here.
Essentially, but if you look at the structure of both your example and what has led to occur here, at the time, you know, the security interest has to logically have been released at or before the time the assets were transferred, because the transferee got them free and clear of that security interest.
But that's always going to be true. Otherwise, the transferee doesn't want to buy an asset, doesn't want to pay money for an asset that's underwater because it's encumbered. So that's always going to be true.
Do you have any authority to support your theory?
I look for authority. I can't find authority either way.
Did you look in other states?
Yeah, I did. UFTA is enacted, I think, 49 states, and it, as far as I've been able to tell, as far as published decisions, it hasn't been addressed. So I have to fall back on logic. Logically, as I said, the transfer, you know, when the transfer occurred, the time the transfer of the businesses occurred, they were free and clear of any liens. Otherwise, as the court pointed out, I mean, there would be no point in buying it.
I mean, I think Judge Gabriel's question bottoms on a principle that asset has a unique meaning for fraudulent transfer cases. And if, forgetting about the accounting definition, if an asset is underwater and it is transferred as part of a transaction that takes away the encumbrance, that's not an asset under custom. You agree with that premise?
I do not. Think specifically what I think 38A102 talks about, the definition of an asset, and it states that an asset is not considered an asset for the purpose of CUPTA to the extent that it is encumbered by a valid lien.
Okay, here you don't dispute the validity of the lien.
Correct. We do not dispute.
I mean, your amended pleading didn't.
Right.
And your pleading did not assert that there was equity in the asset after consideration of the valid lien.
Prior to the transaction, certainly.
Okay.
But essentially, I would modify what is my answer to you previously. This was essentially a two-part closing, or two separate closings here. First was the purchase of healthcare Guarantee Enterprises out of Oklahoma City by Ecotext for $3.2 million. Once that money was transferred to Kairos Capital, who was essentially the seller, Kairos Capital took $2 million of that, gave it to the receiver, and upon receipt of those funds, according to the terms of the party's written transaction, the assets were then transferred to Healthcare Laundry Services. And when they were transferred to Healthcare Laundry Services, they were transferred free and clear of the existing lien due to the discharge by payment. So conceptually, the lien had to be released before the transfer occurred. Once the assets were transferred to Healthcare Laundry Services, the ownership interest, membership interest in Healthcare Laundry Services was then transferred to Ecotext. But I don't have any authority for this either way.
Doesn't this sort of call into question the usual practice with enforcing liens? Typically, the creditor will bid in and purchase it and then resell those assets to another person. Is that, you're saying, in all those cases, that's subject to a fraudulent transfer claim?
No, that's a different type of transaction, I would suggest. That's an Article 9 secured transaction, or liquidation of collateral. What occurred here was a judicial sale, which is a totally different process, subject to a totally different...
So judicial, all right, so in any judicial sale process, is you lose, the creditor loses the protection of the COFDA?
I'm not sure I follow the court's question.
Well, given the, I think the kind of transaction you outlined is not an uncommon transaction. And so therefore, doesn't that call into jeopardy anytime somebody attempts to foreclose or to enforce their security interest through a judicial process?
Well, the creditor here agreed to accept the $2 million payment to release its security interest. And the payment was coming from the sale of the company which owned the assets to a third party. So when the money was paid for that, paid to, in this, let's say, on the hospital services, that money was immediately given to the receiver for the use of the bank. At that point, under the terms of the APA, the bank released its security interest. So at the time of the transfer of the assets of the business from Omni Hospital to Omni Linux, the security interest had been released. In other words,
how much time passed between those two transactions?
I think it all happened within an hour. It's not in the record, but we do have documentation on that. It wasn't simultaneous. It happened on the same day. Unless the court has any more questions on that issue, I think it sounds like the court has been is familiar with the briefs. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd like to reserve.
Very well.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brent Cohen, Lewis Rocco Rothkerber. Registration number 11297. I represent the appellee, Omni Living Services LLC, the purchaser of the assets in this transaction.
Was this an asset purchase or a stock purchase?
Asset purchase.
Okay.
I'd like to start with a general proposition that I think that is a matter of law and logic, sort of spills over into all the issues that we're dealing with today, and that is this. In a receivership proceeding, in any court-supervised transaction, there must come a time in which the parties know that the transaction is complete. There must come a point in which they are assured that what they have negotiated and what has been approved by the court on notice to all interested parties is going to be binding. And that happened in this case when the sale order was entered on July 2nd, 2012. The reason that these claims failed at the district court level, the reason that they failed here, is that they represent a collateral attack on that sale order. On that sale order that was issued on a motion that was noticed out to all parties, including judgment lien holders, including the appellants, to which they did not object.
Counsel, they attempted to intervene, and intervention wasn't granted until after the sale.
They still had remedies, Your Honor. The motion to intervene was filed on the same date that the motion to approve the sale was filed, June 21st. The intervention wasn't granted until after the sale order on July 31st. Once intervention was granted, as a matter of law, they became bound by that sale order. At that point, they had remedies, Rule 60, a right to appeal, whatever. They could have done something. They could have challenged the order. They could have appealed the order. They did nothing. Instead, they attempted to file a lawsuit to collaterally attack the order. And so that's why, regardless of the fact that they weren't intervened in the case, they still had notice. They still had standing. They could have objected.
So there was a final appealable order before they filed their lawsuit, you're saying?
The order was entered on July 2nd. I don't think that the appeal period would have run by the time they filed the lawsuit on August 7th. They still had a little more time to appeal.
I mean, the case was still ongoing, wasn't it?
The receivership proceeding, yes.
So was there a final judgment that could have been appealed at that point?
As a general rule, the answer to that question is yes. And I'm going to argue by analogy to the bankruptcy code, in which sale orders are frequently entered and they are considered final for purposes of appeal. That's pretty much black letter law. In receivership context, I would say that it's the majority position that a sale order is final for purposes of appeal. There's a good discussion out of the appeals court in Ohio on that subject. Recently, I would say that is the general rule. So remedies existed under Rule 60, under a right to appeal. The point here is that they did nothing except file a lawsuit to collaterally attack an order that was becoming final.
I mean, could taking the allegations of the complaint, the intervention filings is true. I mean, are those issues that could have been raised in an appeal of the sale order? I mean, there's no record on which they could argue any of those facts. So I guess I'm accepting it as a concept, your position, but I just don't see it as having a practical implication.
I think that they could have been raised in the context of a Rule 60 motion, which they could have timely filed as of the date that they filed their lawsuit on August 7th. And I think all of those issues could have been raised. In fact, Rule 60 specifically applies to amendment in the case of mistake, fraud, and certainly they've alleged fraud.
Okay.
But they let that go. So on that basis, it really comes down to this. In a contest between bare allegations in a complaint, somewhat fanciful at that, and findings and conclusions made in a final sale order, the sale order must prevail. That's what this case is about. With respect to the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, if you examine the asset purchase agreement that's attached to the motion seeking approval of the sale, you'll note that the assets for purposes of that agreement include the UCC collateral. And UCC collateral is defined as all of Omni's property. So there was absolutely no doubt in terms of what was taking place in the context of this transaction. If you analyze that asset purchase agreement, you'll see that it's a little bit belt and suspenders. On the one hand, the bank is relying on its UCC rights. It clearly had a perfected security interest in these assets that has never been challenged. On the other hand, the suspenders included the receivership order and the order, the sale order entered by the court. So, in a way, the parties here were looking for double certainty. And that was the intention here. And if you look in the documents, look at the record, that's what you'll find. There can be no doubt that the assets that were being transferred were encumbered by the bank's lien. Now, the bank, I suppose, could have accepted whatever it wanted in terms of value for those assets. The price was pegged at $2 million. In retrospect, it's now alleged that there should have been more, but that's what the bank asked, and that's what they got. And for purposes of the Uniform Transfer Act, this is the transfer, a conveyance, if you will, both under Article 9 and under receivership law, of this property. And encumbered property simply cannot be assets for purposes of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act.
If I can interrupt you, Mr. Cohen,
yes,
let me, I understand the argument about there were no assets here. Let's assume for a minute that we would say there were sufficiently assets. Why isn't the amended complaint at least plead enough facts to at least state a claim under CAFTA? You know, again, put aside the issue of was there an asset here. I mean, as I understand it, they basically allege this is all was a setup by insiders to deprive them, a debtor, of their right to collect. I recognize the bank you know, got its money. But why isn't that sufficient? I mean, I'm of course oversimplifying, but the gist of their argument is all these insiders got together. At the end of the day, the Kings ended up with control of the same company they had before, and the people who did not left hold of the bank were the plaintiffs here. Why didn't that at least state a claim? They may lose at trial, but why isn't that enough?
In the vacuum, it would. In the context of the sale order, it cannot. For this reason, the findings and conclusions made in the sale order specifically contradict and undercut the critical portions of those claims. Specifically, the sale order specifies that adequate written notice was given, that the consideration for the transfer of the assets is adequate and constitutes reasonably equivalent value and fair consideration. You mentioned Roger King. There's a specific finding in here that he will not receive any compensation and not have any ongoing equity interest in the business. There's a specific conclusion that the APA is binding on all parties, including lien holders, which included judgment lien holders, the appellants. And finally, the transactions contemplated by the APA are undertaken by purchaser without collusion and in good faith. This gets back to the point I previously made. In a contest between allegations in a complaint and a final order containing findings and conclusions, the final order must prevail.
It reminded me, and I should know this, and I apologize. It was the sale order referenced in the amended complaint. I mean, is it, I recognize that when a contract is attached or a document is attached, you get to consider it on a 12b-5. I get that. I'm just kind of wondering, and this is really a procedural question. I heard your argument that the sale order is binding, and I'm trying to figure out on 12b-5 how that happens. I mean, does it have to be referenced in the complaint, or can you look at a document outside the complaint to make those findings?
My understanding is that in the context of a 12b-5, the court can consider matters of record in the case, whether or not they're attached to the complaint. And certainly the sale order was of record in that case.
All right, thank you.
Other questions?
Is assume that, this is hypothetical, that Judge Martinez was defrauded, that there was a whole bunch of fraud going on, and I'm certainly not accusing your firm or anything like that, but assuming that that in a hypothetical, can't an action for fraud, don't the rule permit an action to be brought for fraud thereafter?
I think Rule 60 contemplates that, and Rule 60's, I know the title specifically mentions fraud, and I think that your remedy under Rule 60 is to seek to amend the sale order. And I don't believe that the rules give you the ability to circumvent that by filing a separate lawsuit.
Okay.
So, in other words, a procedure is prescribed under the rules. It wasn't followed. Thank you. I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Very briefly. As I understand counsel's argument, we were stopped essentially from bringing a complaint for fraudulent transfer, given the fact that we did not object to the motion for sale itself, and also, as I understand it, that we were obligated somehow to proceed under Rule 60. And we're of nothing in Rule 60 that makes it the exclusive remedy in that situation, and there is nothing legally to preclude us from going the way we went. I believe it's the preferable way to go because the actual sale involved in some purchase third-party purchasers and unringing the bell would have been problematic. This is exactly the type of situation that the UFTA was designed to resolve. Again, going to the court's question to counsel, I think under the Stegman decision, which is cited in both briefs, the court could take a look at it at the its prior orders in the case in determining dismissal. More precisely, the rule is that where those matters that the court can take a look at directly contradict the allegations in the complaint, the court is not obligated, as normally is, to consider those allegations to be true. In this case, the court's orders upon which the district court relied apply to the APA. There were some things, as detailed in my brief, that the court was not told. It's apples and oranges. I don't think there is a contradiction between the two. I want to go back with my remaining time to the issue of whether or not the assets of these two companies were assets for purposes of the UFTA. I mean, obviously that concerns the court, so it concerns me as well. And going back to what counsel was arguing, I disagree that this is a common or garden variety type of transaction. I think that may explain the dearth of law on this specific point. This was a lot different than an Article 9 sale. An Article 9 sale, a secure creditor takes possession of the property, sells it, and takes the proceeds and, you know, applies the proceeds towards the debt. This was different. The bank, according to the APAs, agreed to accept the sum of $2 million in return in satisfaction of its debt and agreed in return for payment of that $2 million to release its security interest as well as all guarantees by the individuals. That $2 million was paid. The assets were then transferred. At the time they were transferred, logically, they were not subject to that security interest. So under the plain language of the UFTA, these were assets, and they were not encumbered at the time of the transfer. I am 12 seconds over, unless the court has any questions. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.